everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics. I'm Andrew, and as per usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Rob.
Hello!
And not Mick, because he's a little bit under the weather.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange situation with Mick. He works hard, and then he works hard again, and then he works hard again, and yeah.
I think it's called having a job.
It is called having a job. I'm surprised at how much of a job Mick has.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of it, to be honest.
Really?
Too much like blooming hard work to me.
It could be worse.
He could have had to read a gigantic pile of comics for our November Comics Blowout special.
Yes, which you and I did.
We did. Is blowout a weird term?
Yes. I am still questioning why we decided to use the word blowout. Because it's something, I mean, when you're driving and you have a tyre blowout, it's a dangerous thing.
Just like having too much comic knowledge is a dangerous thing because the man doesn't want it.
No, the man does not want all of that comics knowledge.
That if you want to stick it to big comics, listen to 4Panel, the only anti-establishment. God, no, we are definitely not the only anti-establishment comics podcast out there.
No, we're not. I was about to say, I'm pretty sure there are plenty of others. But anyway, Andrew, I think
you're right. That's enough stalling to pad out the runtime on this one. Why don't you kick things off, Rob?
Right. So I'm going to pick things off. This is what
that's it, isn't it? This whole show is just us pretending to coin new terms of phrase just because we flubbed pronunciations.
Well, this is what happens when you finish a 13-hour shift. Get to bed at 7 o'clock in the morning and then get woken up again at 10:30 and not have any rest. So, I'm going to attempt in my half asleep state or half brain awake state, whatever you want to call it, I'm going to attempt to cover a manga. Now, I'm normally good at this.
Right, this is literally your specialist subject, Rob.
Exactly. Right.
I'd say I believe in you, but I have been doing this show for like 5 years.
This is true. So, I'm going to attempt a manga. The manga that I'm going to attempt is actually a pretty straightforward one for me. It is Bakemonogatari, which is a combination of the words Bakemono and Monogatari, basically monster story. And this is based on the light novels by Nisio Isin, and it's got art by Ogret. If anyone who is familiar with Ogret's work, I think he did that one about the inline, that really fanservice-y heavy sci-fi one about the inline skaters. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, this is Bakemonogatari.
Fury on Ice, that's what it's called, isn't it?
No, inline skaters, not ice skaters.
I got really excited for a second that I knew a thing.
It's like, Fury on Ice, it was sci-fi. I'm just like, why?
It's skating in it.
You're going to get some diehard Yuri on Ice fans chasing you down the street now, Andrew. It's not science fiction. It's art.
Look, if it gets people to pay attention to the show.
So anyway, this has got the art by Ogret, but it is based on the original story by Nisio Isin. This actually starts off with the high school boy, Koyomi Araragi, and he is on the very first page, given a bike ride to a girl in kind of the typical Japanese high school. Girl sitting on the back of the bike while the boy rides the bike and pedals forward. It's one of those scenes that anyone familiar with manga or anime would be familiar with. The girl on the back of the bike.
That even I know what you're talking about.
Exactly. The girl on the back of the bike is Hitagi Senjogahara. And she, you know, it's a very romantic scene right at the beginning and everything looks fine until you get a few pages in, because the second page is quite literally, there are various school-based educational utensils like compasses and set squares and staplers and Tippex and pencil sharpeners and scissors and various things like that. And then you, as you go in, you begin to realize what's going on. See, somehow, Hitagi Senjogahara has all of these items and more that she uses as potential weapons, and she carries them under her skirt, like a ninja.
Now look, I'm not no scholar on Japanese history, but I don't think that's what the ninjas did, Rob.
No, they didn't. They didn't appear in the middle of the night and do your homework. See, here's the thing. Senjogahara has a problem. And it's a problem that Araragi knows about, but isn't sure what to do about. See, one of the earliest meetings between the two of them was when she was falling from the top of a building, and Araragi stuck his hand out and caught her, only to realize she weighed virtually nothing at all. And so that the two of them somehow became friendly-ish. She's got this combative relationship with Araragi, and he's amazed at the fact that she has so much stationery under her skirt. How he finds it out, I'm not going to go into. But the first story in this is actually called Hitagi Crab, and it all has to do with weight. And it's all to do with why Senjogahara doesn't weigh anything, what's happened to her. It turns out that Araragi isn't quite human, and there are various people who are, they look kind of scummy and seedy, but they're also extremely powerful in certain ritualistic magic and ritualistic forms of belief. So what you have is this weird kind of postmodern urban fairy tale, I suppose you'd call it. I'm a bit confused as to why this manga came out, because this already has an anime adaptation, which came out a while ago, several years ago, in fact. It's a very, very famous anime adaptation, had a lot of plaudits, had a lot of fans.
Oh, so it's gone from, like, light novel to anime to manga.
Yeah. So
usually those last two are, like, the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. So you understand my confusion as to why you've basically done an almost shot-for-shot re-adaptation of the anime into a manga. And yes, some of the artwork is great in this. Don't get me wrong. Some of the artwork is amazing in this. I mean, the design of certain scenes is, it's got tension and power and flair and everything that you want in a kind of, in a shonen manga. But then I look back and I think, okay, it's all great doing the artwork. So yeah, he's got that flair, but he does like his fan service as well. And that's where I kind of run into a problem with Bakemonogatari. I was never the biggest fan of the original story. I always thought that Ovnisio Eisen's works are of the Monogatari type works. I know that Katanagatari isn't exactly one of the Monogatari series because, you know, that's all the Bakemonogatari stuff. But Katanagatari is still one of my favourite stories by him. And the anime adaptation for that, I really wish they'd release it in the UK, but they won't. But I'm not going to get into that. Bakemonogatari.
Yeah. Oh, that's why they've gone in the manga. It's like some kind of, that's the only way to get a more global release.
Yeah, that's the thing. It doesn't make sense. It's like the Wookiees living with the Ewoks. You know, it does not make sense. Why would you release the manga adaptation of the anime, of the book?
I mean, I guess same reason as anything else, because they think it will sell.
But why wouldn't you just go and buy the anime, which is available for sale in the UK? See what I mean?
I don't know.
Because then you can just sit back in a chair with some popcorn and a drink and watch the anime series and not have to hold your hands up in front of you and read. And then wait for the next volume of the manga to come out because the entire anime series is already there on disc for you to watch the entire story.
Bob?
Yeah?
Oh, buddy old pal.
I'm basically done, by the way.
Could you maybe not install in our audience the virtues of not reading things on our podcast about reading things?
Well, I'm only saying for things like this, okay? For many other things, there are no adaptations. You will have to read, so learn. But for things like this, where you have options and where the original adaptation has been out for a while and was very well received, maybe, and is basically the complete story, maybe go watch that. Save your money. Do something useful. Give it to charity or something.
Or use it to buy a copies of Dark Horse's Our Encounters with Evil.
Actually, that's also a good option.
By Asterix, Mike Mignola.
Hang on, what?
Warwick Johnson.
When did Asterix start writing comics? This is some weird meta thing, isn't it?
No, Asterix didn't write this comic. Much like in the same way that Mike Mignola did not write this comic. Dark Horse, Dark Horse, DH, friends, colleagues, people who give us comics. This story was written and drawn by Warwick Johnson Cadwell. It's based on characters created by Mike Mignola. He doesn't deserve to be on the front of the book, then.
What? Are they... what?
I don't know. I think it might even be, like, some weird... No, because I'm sure we've had, like, BPR. Have we had... Then we need to dig out some of the old, like, BPRD spin-off things.
Why?
See if, like... Well, just see if... Does Mike Mignola's name appear, like, on the cover, even though he didn't actually write or draw any of it?
That's a good point.
Because I feel like it might be... He might have some kind of deal where he gets a writing credit on, like, anything based off of one of his properties.
Oh, right. I know some people do have that kind of deal.
Yeah, but I have, like, a vague memory of Mike having something like that. But anyway, I digress. So, this is The Adventures of Professor J.T. Mr. Knox.
I'm just checking some of the covers online. Hellboy and the BPRD, 1952. On the cover says Mike Mignola, John Arcudi. I think this is John Arcudi.
Yeah, but I think those ones, Mike Mignola did have one of the... check. I think it was BPRD Vampire.
BPRD Vampire?
Yeah, because I think we covered that one a while back. Yes, I think that was the title.
Yes, it's got Mike Mignola's name on the cover.
Then I think it might be something like that, because I'm pretty sure... That was Gabriel Barr and...
Yes, it was.
Fabio Moon?
Yes, it was. Fabio Moon.
Yeah!
Which is...
I think they were the ones who actually, like, did the story.
Which, I'll be honest, is an amazing name, right? For a gentleman thief.
It is. But yeah, I feel like Mike Mignola should, like, not have a full-on credit for things, but whatever. I guess it's not hurting nobody.
Yeah, it's fine.
So yeah, Professor Meinhardt and Mr. Knox. Let's see if any of our listeners have very long memories indeed. They might remember that those were two characters from Mr. Higgins Comes Home.
Yes!
Yeah, they were the vampire hunters who appeared in that. And I think... Because that's why it was drawn by Warwick Johnson. Mike Mignola has done what he does and kind of gifted those characters to him. Change for getting a writer's credit on the front cover... Which is a thing that I'm maybe getting too obsessed with and should just stop talking about.
Yes, because you know for a fact, if you had the opportunity, you would do the same.
I definitely would. Yeah, this is nice. It's just a series of short stories kind of detailing their adventures with vampires. As much as I've harped on about Mike Mignola, I really now hate that my main point of praise... Is that this reminds me a hell of a lot of the Hellboy short stories.
Sorry. Oh. The irony in that almost killed me there.
Yeah, it's good because it's mostly them kind of just discovering weird things. Like in one of the stories, they're on the trail of a vampire and track him down to... A whole village of vampires, only to find that, like, that whole village, basically their position is, hey, this guy's a super jerk. He turned us all into vampires. We're going to lock him up in a tower.
Okay.
And by the time, like, the professor and Mr. Knox get there, they're basically making the tower smaller and smaller. So it's now just like a tiny silver box in a big room with it, like, the withered remains of the vampire trapped in there.
But the whole town is still vampires.
Yeah. But they have sworn themselves to basically, they're only going to drink the blood of, like, thieves and murderers. Because that town has a reputation for being, like, a great hideaway spot for criminals.
Yeah.
And they're just going to dedicate their entire afterlives to watching over this one vampire because he's such a jerk.
That's a great idea.
I do. I thought that was really fun. But not quite as fun as the idea of, like, they come across a whole horde of bats, only then it's revealed it's actually two vampires who fought each other in a duel and ended up dismembering each other. Only then, or like their individual body parts came back as like vampire bat monsters And now they're all trying to, like, come back together to merge into one big monster.
So is this, like, two... Is this, like, a gang fight involving bats, which are actually body parts of different vampires?
Basically, only it ends much better than that.
Okay. This sounds awesome. Now I've got some weird vampire version of West Side Story going on in my head.
Do you know what else is awesome?
What?
A vampire hunter who is a werewolf.
What?
He is a werewolf, and vampires can hire him to hunt down vampire hunters.
Okay. I can see the logic to it.
Exactly.
So does that mean the vampire hunters can hire a werewolf hunter to hunt down the werewolf who's hunting them?
Maybe.
Oh my god, this is going to end up in weird territory, isn't it?
Yeah, this definitely ends with some, like, horrifying Ouroboros.
Yeah. Or
just hunters hunting hunters hunting hunters hunting hunters.
Yeah, or a bizarre Benny Hill sketch.
Even better.
Vampire chasing newborn young lady, being chased by a vampire hunter, being chased by a werewolf, being chased by a werewolf hunter.
Anyway, yeah. This series is a lot, well, I think it's a series. It kind of ends on a sort of to-be-continued type note.
Yeah.
Nah, it's tremendous fun. The art, I think, works for the most part. It's like it's got a bit of a cartoony merged with to be super incredibly highbrow and awkward. Sort of looks a little bit like Gustav Klimt artwork.
Okay.
Like that strange kind of weird sense of perspective, which makes it all seem a bit unsettling.
Yeah.
The only thing I wasn't too big a fan of was the colouring, because the colours are just very bright. And I think a more muted palette would suit the tone much better.
Okay.
God, look at me. Look at me with my actual arts criticism.
Yeah, it's like proper arts criticism as well.
Boom. We've made it. We've hit the big time.
Just on the wrong podcast.
Damn it, this is it. We've got Patreon subscribers. We've got classy content. Next, we take Manhattan.
Speaking of Manhattan, let's cut across to... Well, is it New Jersey she lives in? I think it is.
Literally a different state to the one Manhattan's in, but okay.
No, sorry, it's not New Jersey. It's Jersey City she lives in.
Jersey City is in New Jersey, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So anyway, speaking of Manhattan, let's head over to America for some Ms. Marvel. Now, this is Ms. Marvel Destined, and this is Volume 1. Or the first trade paperback of Ms. Marvel, but not the G. Willow Wilson Ms. Marvel. This is the Ms. Marvel written by Saladin Ahmed, with art by Minkyu Young, inks by Juan Velasco and Minkyu Young, colours by Ian Herring, and letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. And
nice. Side tangent, I read a really good miniseries by Saladin Ahmed the other day.
Oh, what was it?
That's called Abbott. It's about this black female reporter in the 1970s who also has to fight, like, occult forces of evil.
Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty rad.
I will investigate this more after the show. But for now, back to Ms. Marvel. And it starts off on another world in the far future with a dad telling his daughter about a bedtime story about the Destined One. And his daughter says, please tell me about the Destined One. And he goes, okay, after this, you're going straight to sleep. The Destined One was born long, long ago on a strange and distant world called Earth. She was that planet's greatest hero, and they called her Ms. Marvel.
Whoa, Nat. Hold your horses there. I like you as much as the next guy, but you ain't no squirrel girl.
Hang on. She does team up with Squirrel Girl. We know this, but it does go...
I guess that does make her the greatest bioson.
Well, I mean, it goes on to describe her, the story. Now, her deeds and actions, because at the moment the story's being told, Kamala is fighting a guy called Deathbringer who's basically going, Ms. Marvel, foolish girl, you can never defeat Deathbringer. Surrender now or be destroyed. Which is typical bad guy speak for, look, we're going to have a fight now. Can we just get on with it? So anyway, back to the...
Can we do the punching? I've got a roast on home.
Yeah. The Destined One was known far and wide for her on her world for her valor. Her fists were like boulders. Her eyes like fire. Sounds a bit like Hercules. Her spirit was fearless, and
also
her
the
man.
Thing.
Sorry.
Also the thing.
Yeah. Also the thing. Yeah. Her spirit was fearless, and her manner was bold. Some say the Destined One could shrink out of her enemy's sight. Some say that she could grow to the size of a giant. Noble she was in bearing and solemn in spirit. The Destined One was beloved and celebrated by all of the people of her world, and she was always true, a true and steadfast friend. And that's where it kind of trails off with this other world story narrative. And it goes on to Kamala finding out that her dad knows that she's Ms. Marvel, because her mum's told her, and she's kind of running around the city, fighting off all these monsters. One of them, ironically enough, does look like a werewolf. And they all kind of dissolve into this goop when she beats them. But then they pick up a signal. Her and her friend, forgot his name, pick up a signal from Kamala's house.
Bruno, I think?
I think it's Bruno, yeah. Pick up a signal from Kamala's house, and she goes home and finds that her mum and dad have dissolved into goop as well. And she's panicking, thinking something's happened to her mum and dad. But Bruno tells her, no, no, they're still alive. We'll find them. This was that alien goop. They're basically constructs. So they eventually track down Kamala's parents. But along the way, they run into Josh, the guy who hates Kamala and the rest of them. The weird thing is, I like Ms. Marvel. I like the Ms. Marvel stories, and I like what Saladin Ahmed is doing as a follow-up to G. Willow Wilson, because he is referring back to characters who were in G. Willow Wilson's run, like Josh, who basically joined the bad guys because he didn't like superheroes or anything like that. And now he's working as a professional henchman for the people who take care of him. And he's come back to town. He's like, I'm going to beat you up now. And Kamala's going, no, you're not. Where are my parents? He's like, what's happened to your parents? I don't know anything about this. What's going on? Immediately worried about Kamala's parents. So I like that, you know, the fact that the characters have this history to them, because they're all like school friends or school frenemies. And so, as she's leaving, Kamala says to him, look, you know, tell me if you need any help finding a job. I'll sort you out. And he's like, okay. You know, even bad guys need a hand. It's a very, you know how The Flash does it with all of his enemies, so to speak.
Yeah, it just helps people out.
Yeah. I like the fact that Kamala's a lot more down to earth like that in her own comic, and she's not all, you know, holier than thou righteous. But anyway, Kamala finds her parents, and it turns out that her parents were kidnapped by three wise old men who've come from another world for the Destined One.
Wait a minute. But she's the Destined One.
Yes, that's why they've come for her. But anyway, see, here's the thing, right? Ms. Marvel is not a complicated or challenging read. It's enjoyable, you know? Ms. Marvel has been enjoyable for a while, but it's not a complicating or challenging read. You can figure out what's going on fairly quickly. And this story is quite literally all about Kamala Khan getting an upgrade. Not to her powers, well, technically to her powers, but she basically is getting an upgrade so she can take on bigger enemies in the future. And I am curious to see how that's going to play out. I do think that there's this push with popular characters like Ms. Marvel. There's this push to kind of make them go cosmic, make them go outside of planet Earth and fight the big bad guys out in space and stuff like that, and have all sorts of weird adventures. I'm like, well, you know, do we really need that? Isn't there space for some grounded heroes, some heroes who are basically... I mean, Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man is a prime example.
Yeah, I think Ms. Marvel is very much that. What makes her a great hero is being tied to that local community.
Yeah, because everyone in the community knows her. At the beginning, where she wrecks someone's shop, he shouted out for wrecking the shop, and she's like, I'm going to help you fix it. And I like that attitude, you know, I like that mentality that they've got going in the comic, and I don't want them to lose that, and I'm just a bit worried that with the way that this ends, with the upgrades that they give her in this comic that's going to lead down the path of, you know, becoming this, cosmic superhero type character.
Yeah. Although I guess the thing with comics, though, is that even if she does, it'll get rebooted sooner or later.
Yeah, probably.
Either by the time the series ends, or when, like, someone else comes along and says, you know what I miss? When Ms. Marvel was just a plucky girl looking at it.
Yeah. The thing is, I don't want them to reboot Ms. Marvel. I'd rather they kind of discontinued it but left it alone. The reason why is because there's this nice, cathartic legacy going on from Captain Marvel, the original Marvel, going to the original Ms. Marvel, who's now Captain Marvel, and on to this Ms. Marvel. Do you see what I mean? And it might have happened by accident, but that's basically how it is right now. And I quite like the fact that that's there.
Is it bad that my brain immediately went to the death of Captain Marvel, but it's kind of Ms. Marvel in the arms of death, and she's just sort of glooping all about the place?
Hang on, are we talking about Kamala, or are we talking about the original Ms. Marvel? Oh,
no. Kamala, I mean, and she's just like stretching all her arms out.
Yeah, that's bad.
And also possibly taking a selfie.
Yeah, that would be bad.
Oh, would it?
It would be amazing, but it would also be bad.
I like Ms. Marvel. I really enjoy how her powers are just like really weak.
Yeah, that's the thing I like about it is, I mean, she's basically kind of an upgraded version of Mr. Fantastic, isn't she?
Yeah. Yells out M-Biggin.
Yeah. She's not as stretchy as he is, but she's stretchy enough to basically give bad guys some serious trouble and, you know, fish out the keys from when they fall in the gutter.
Yeah. I think she's stretchy enough to do the most important thing with stretchy power, which is to make your fist a really big fist and punch people with it.
Yes. Anyway, Andrew.
Yep. Back to me. So next up, I have got Magus of the Library.
Okay.
By Mitsu Izumi. Based on Kafna of the Wind by Sophie Schwimm. Translated by Hiroto Hamada. So, this is, like I said, Volume 2. Listeners may remember I covered Volume 1. Or they may not. It's fine. I barely remember covering it as well.
I remember you covering it. You said it was lovely artwork, kind of dull story.
Yes. Also, the main thing I remember saying is that by the end of that one, it felt like basically it had gotten up to the point where the story starts.
Yeah.
And I think that was true, because this, like, if you had told me this was Volume 1, I would believe you.
Really?
Yeah, because, I mean, it starts like a very typical beginning. First of all, it introduces you to the concept of the world. So, basically, there was an event known as the Emissary of Wormwood, which was a big kind of apocalyptic event until 7 Magi used their powers to save the world from extinction, only for that to be followed by a big war between all the different races. And now it's kind of 100 years later, and there's still an uneasy peace, which, hey, also helps to explain why in Volume 1 everyone was kind of ludicrously racist.
Yes, it does.
Because it's much better when you can read a story and go, oh, I see. These people are very biased against other races because they're still living in the shadow of a gigantic war where you basically couldn't trust anyone who wasn't the same species of you.
Which...
Rather than just, these people are bad racists.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, they still are bad racists. But at least now you get why.
Well, yeah, there's more context to it. You're not simply going to say, okay, you're a horrible person because you hate these people because they're different. You can say, you're a horrible person, but, you know, there may actually be some good in you. I understand you're only like this because this happened. So you're still getting over that. But once you got over it, you may be okay.
Yeah, it's just it's a better story to have.
Yeah.
Oh. These people are racist friends. We can work to resolve that.
Yeah, that's basically what I'm trying to say.
Racism is bad. Wouldn't it be bad if you had a racist done?
I shouldn't laugh, but... Oh.
So I'm trying to remember Volume 1, it was basically just that a lot.
Yeah.
Don't be mean to elves just because they have pointy ears. There, now we're all caught up in Volume 1.
Yes.
So this this continues the story of Theophumus, a young boy who is determined to travel across the land to the great city of Aftzark and become a Kafner, which is basically a fancy librarian.
A Kafner?
Kafner. K-A-F-N-A.
See, depending on where you're from in England, that might end up sounding like governor.
That's, you know, considering we've just talked about Kamala Khan.
Yeah.
That was a bit of a stretch, Rob.
I said, depending on where you're from in England.
Anyway, Theo. Theo is a character I kind of go back and forth on, because he is, like, your very typical, he's just a nice guy protagonist.
Yeah.
Like, he's just, he wants to do a thing. Will he do the thing? Probably, because he's the extra special chosen one. But he's also just so gosh darn nice, Rob.
It's difficult to hate him, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel like the actual other characters in this book were always like, oh, here comes Theo, he's gosh darn long-eared elf boy. What's he playing at? But then he's just, he's always so nice and helpful and concerned about your problems that you just go, oh, Theo, you scamp. And then you kind of grab one of his cheek and go, girl. But yeah, the series, it was a lot more fun. Starts off with your kind of typical journeying from town to town plot.
Yeah.
Since, you know, kind of goes to a town, finds a problem, helps resolve the problem, maybe meets a character along the way who is clearly going to be like part of the supporting cast.
Yeah.
As you sort of his journey on to Aftzark. Yeah, it's nice. It's fun. There's a thing, like again, what I was talking about with the racism is he meets a young girl who's got a real thing about the Rakta, who are basically just, they kind of come across as looking quite traditionally Chinese. And she, you know, she hates them. She says things like, well, they're so rude. They like keep bonking me on the head and sticking their tongues out. And so Theo takes her to the library and kind of teaches her, no, actually, that's just their way of greeting people. And, you know, saying, we are family now. And it's just, you know, nice. Problems get resolved. People hug it out.
Lots of feeling good.
Lots of feeling good. And then we also meet some of the characters who are also going to appear in the series, like Mihona, who is another trainee Kafta. I like her a lot. She kind of has a thing, like she'll keep saying like really serious things. Like when they get to Aftzark, she just turns to Theo and says, right, this is it. We shall speak no longer. When next we speak, it shall be as Kafners or not at all. And then turns away and then kind of starts going, just nailed it. Only for Theo likes it. Actually, I'm kind of walking in the same direction.
I like it.
It is. I liked it. Right up until the final chapters where kind of Theo gets to Aftzark. He meets a couple more characters. Actually, I should probably mention the other characters he meets, which I was maybe trying to avoid because I forgot what their names were. And that's it. Wait, wait. There was a list of races at the back.
So did you say list of races or list of racists?
I mean, I guess either or. Like, basically everyone who isn't Theo is at least a teensy bit racist.
Right, okay.
Like an awkward family manga form.
Oh, awkward family reunion of the library is not a title that rolls off the tongue.
Alv, that's his name. He's the fun kind of streetwise kid who's been trying to be a Kafner for funsies. And Peperico, yeah, that's it. She's like a pixie or a sprite or something. She's the energetic one. You know, you've read a manga.
Yeah.
So I like them well enough. They just seem very kind of typical stock characters.
Mm.
And everything's all nice and feel good. And then Magus of the Library becomes a horror manga. Because they get to the library, and this ends with kind of the beginning of the Kafner exam. And they're given a big book full of questions. Basically told, you must, basically, you know, here's a stack of books. Here's a bunch of questions on different topics. I expect several, like, well-researched and well-written essays. And you've only got 3 days to do it, and you'll need to work non-stop. And, oh, God, the flashbacks, Rob. The flashbacks.
Okay.
It's like university all over again.
Ah, that's what you meant by horror manga.
I do just Literally, there's not a Junji Ito book on the planet that makes me shiver as just the idea of having to, like, write essays that will be graded.
Yeah.
But yeah, I quite like this manga now.
Cool.
As I said with the first one, the artwork's great. The only thing I wasn't too big a fan of is Theo seems to have some kind of, well, I was going to say vague magic-y powers that seem to be connected to the elements. And I suspect, given that this is based on a book called Kafna of the Wind, might be some kind of wind elemental abilities.
Yeah. They kind of give things away with the title, don't they?
Yeah. And I think just, there are a couple of instances where stories just end with him going, oh, wait, turns out I'm magic and just can just fix things. I feel like that's just a bit of an anticlimax. Especially doesn't gel with what I feel like should be the main message of this book, which is tackling problems through, like, hard work and learning about things.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing, with a lot of the racism, it's the idea of, well, you only hate other races because you don't know about them. And once you can actually learn and see them as people, you can even form those bonds.
Yeah. Excellent.
And that, Rob, that is how you promote a positive message about reading on your reading.
Hey, all I can say is that's perfectly fine.
Just go watch the anime instead.
Hey, it's Bakemonogatari. I'm not really the biggest fan of it in the first place, so I'm good if you want to go watch the anime for that. Megas the Library doesn't have an anime adaptation yet, as far as I know, although I will check on that, because I have been out of the loop for a bit. But anyway, I'm going to take over the reins again with another manga. Yeah.
Oh, look at that lovely mango cast.
So anyway, this is created by Type Moon with art by Shiramine. And when I say Type Moon, I do mean, for all you people who do recognize the name, yes, I do mean that Type Moon. The Type Moon that gave us Lunar Legend, Tsukihime, Karano Kyokai, and Fate Stay Night. This is the story from them, and it is volume one of the official adaptation of the Type Moon phenomenon that has become one of the most popular mobile games in the world.
Called, mobile games. I knew what those words meant.
Yes, and it's called Fate Grand Order, Mortalis Stella.
Okay, now we're back to the idea of what's going on.
Yes, and it starts off with a guy who's throwing out a weird, very long-eared dog type thing called Cathpalog, and saying, go make contact with that which is truly beautiful. But how can you know what beauty really means unless you look on the inside? He doesn't say that last bit, I said that. But anyway, the scene shifts from there to a base where a girl with glasses called Marsh is being told she needs to do this and that and the other. She meets a master candidate who is called Ritsuka Fujimaru, and they are in training to do various things. See, what's happened is they're trying to protect humanity through this weird, and I'm not going to go in, it's very, very convoluted and complicated idea.
Good, because I was going to say, I'm lost already.
Oh, God, yeah, I got lost. See, I had to review the two Fate Extella games, and that confused me just as much. And then I tried playing Fate Grand Order, and that confused me even more. So I approach the Fate franchise now with several things. I have watched Fate Stay Night and Fate Zero and Fate Stay Night Unlimited Blade Works, both the old and the new version. And I enjoyed it, the new version of Unlimited Blade Works. I thought Fate Zero was an amazing series, and it changed the way I looked at Fate Stay Night. After that, I'm out, basically. It's a bit too convoluted for me. And this just kind of, the whole Fate Grand Order setup is just making it worse. And you have a chief of the facility called Olga Marie Animosphere. And it got me thinking, where are you picking up these names from? She ends up getting taunted to death for all eternity in a black hole.
That's not a name.
Yeah, she ends up getting taunted to death for all eternity in a black hole. Allegedly. Yeah. You don't actually see it happen. All you see is a bloop. And it actually says the word bloop. Right?
Now, yeah, this is one of those bizarre things that basically takes the whole idea of Fate's Day Night and changes it to make it more cataclysmic, more apocalyptic. The Holy Grail War keeps going, but has stopped, but hasn't stopped, but hasn't started. And you're just going, what? But there's servants and masters, and everybody's fighting everybody else. And in this lone cut-off reality that isn't connected to any timelines, you have an evil saber and a dark archer who are trying to do various things. But that's where Mash and this other fellow whose name I've forgotten, Fujimaru, that's where they end up with the chief, Olga, who basically ends up dead. And then, you know, things happen and Mash gets injured. And then Fujimaru takes her as his servant, which is kind of weird. You know, looking at you, Type Moon, what you suggesting with this? And so she becomes all powerful and has a giant shield that can protect her master from all sorts of attacks and stuff. And I'm getting really confused. Why is this happening?
Good, I'm not the only one.
But the story keeps going and it doesn't stop. And I'm going, please, Type Moon, can I get off now? I'm feeling a bit sick. And Type Moon are going, no, you've got to stay on for the rest of the ride. And I'm going, please, can I go home now? And then I go, I am home, so I can put the manga down. Fate Grand Order is very confusing.
Yes, so it appears.
I would recommend Fate Grand Order to people who are playing the mobile game and really into the mobile game and understand the lore of the mobile game and are heavily invested in the mobile game and possibly even some of the anime side of things as well, but mainly the mobile game. If you are of that persuasion, if you are somebody who really enjoys the Fate Grand Order mobile game, then by all means, read this. You might get more out of it than I did. For me, though, I'm coming into it from a weirdly distant left field, which I am extremely familiar with anime and manga and quite a few Japanese mobile games and various other JRPGs and other things like that. And for me to say, this is confusing the crap out of me, I have no idea what's going on. This is way, way, way too complicated in terms of your background story, in terms of your setup, in terms of just the entire world-building structure. It's far too complicated. Overly so. It doesn't need to be like that.
Shall I take us to something much simpler?
Please, because I'm getting a headache just thinking about it.
It's okay. We are going to talk about Star Wars. We are levels.
Yes, a nice and simple Star Wars story.
Exactly. Just good old-fashioned, good verse.
Yes.
So this is written by Jody Howard with art by Rohe Antonio with also some art by Michael Dowling, Joshua Cassara, Geraldo Borges, Iguera, and Juan Gedeon. Colours by Arif Prianto with Lee Lowridge for the first three issues. Neeraj Menon. Oh, no, sorry. Lee Lowridge for issues 1 and 3. Neeraj Menon for issue 2. And Jean-Francois Bulio for 4, and Dono Sanchez Almara for 5, and letters by VC's Joe Caramagna.
He gets everywhere.
He does. So, yeah, I mean, it's Star Wars. I probably hardly need to tell you the plot, but let's check in with our heroes, shall we? Star Wars TIE Fighter, The Shadow Falls. The Empire's glorious victory at the Battle of Hoth has all but smashed their pitiful Rebel Alliance, whose dwindling forces now scatter and flee before the might of the Imperial War Machine. Soon, peace will be restored to the galaxy, and the feared TIE Fighter pilots of Shadow Wing be the ones to secure victory for the Emperor.
Okay.
So yeah, I did want to read that little intro text because I think it does set a good tone for the series.
See, while you were doing that, I was actually tempted to, you know, just in the background go da 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 da.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that we get this book, which is about these kind of 5 TIE fighter pilots: Taso Bruch, Ganem Kahi, Zin Grau, Gila Brebtin, and Litandri.
And I thought Type Moon couldn't do people's names.
Look, It's Star Wars. We've all had a lot of fun in the past with Star Wars. And I've gone slightly insane over it. But today it's fine. They've got weird fantasy. But yeah, but the interesting thing with this series, it's just like, it's kind of looking at these characters who work for the Empire and sort of why in their mind they're still the good guys. Like, I think it does quite interesting thing where they kind of, they see reports of the Death Star blowing up. And to them, that's like a terrorist attack. Like, the rebels just killed millions of people. Although, side tangent, I guess that means they're probably not aware of, like, Alderaan getting blown up. It's suspension of disbelief. Mm. It's cool to see things from the perspective of these kind of, okay, well, the Empire is just basically an extension of the Republic, which is like, that's specifically Ganem Kahi. That's how he sees it. It's just, you know, obviously the Republic, they were the government before. Sure, they're called the Empire now, but it's basically the same people. So even if we maybe don't agree with everything they do, we still need to like defend it from people who want to completely destroy our way of life. And I think that is a neat way of kind of making the story about people who are on the wrong side of history.
That's actually really clever.
It is. It's also just a really tightly written action story. Like, it's about Shadowing basically going to investigate a Star Destroyer that's been abandoned, only to get captured by basically the commander of that Star Destroyer, because it turns out he's gone rogue, and they have to like fight their way out and then get ready for a big final assault in issue 5. And also something this does, which I think it does to really great effect, is not to spoil things, but not all the characters make it out alive.
See, that's...
And I mean, that you, yeah, go ahead.
I'll let you finish first before I make my point.
Oh, I was going to say, and not only do not all the characters not get out alive, they don't get out all alive by issue 3.
See, that for me is the sign of a good story with actual tension and real risks written into it. All of the books that you and I have read, Andrew, how many of them always have the hero's party, all of them survive till the end? Or how many stories have, you know, the hero and his friends are all there at the end to basically face off against the big bad? Nobody's died, nobody's sacrificed, nobody's done anything. Everybody's perfectly fine.
And I think especially with this, there's always that kind of, we need to preserve every character because they could be like the next franchise.
Yeah.
But no, this is one of the rare occasions in a comic book where I've flipped over a page and just gone, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like, it even does a thing. It actually does a thing I've complained about in other books, where it just introduces some new characters in the final two issues. But this one, I think it actually works really well. Because it's like, okay, we're gearing up for the big final battle. And instead of, like, having our best friends by our side who we've gone thick or thin with, it's these two randos.
Yeah, but the thing is, in that sort of circumstance, in that sort of situation, it actually makes more sense. The context is everything with that sort of thing. You know, life goes on, new people join the team. You know, that's just a part and parcel of it, yeah? But you can understand it when you've seen the death of the original members. And you know they're not coming back. That's it. They're out the team because they're dead, right? But at least you know. But with all those other stories, the ones where you didn't like it, it was probably a case of that character's been rebooted how many times?
Yeah. Oh, it's just it's like that Age of Conan, a Bleep thing.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, this is issue 4 or 5. Here's our main villain.
Yeah. Or it's like Dragon Ball, where death really doesn't matter. They just gather the Dragon Balls, get Shenlong to break the rules of life and death and bring everyone back.
And then there's like 7 episodes of just screaming.
Yep.
Yeah. Can I really annoy like all the anime fans?
Go on. I'll allow it.
My favourite Dragon Ball series is Dragon Ball GT.
Ah, Andrew.
The one that everyone hates.
See, I'll be honest, and this is probably going to upset them more than what you just said. I didn't mind Dragon Ball GT. It wasn't a great series, but you know what? It introduced the character of Saiyaman, and for that, I will forgive it a lot, because...
No, I'm not being precocious. I mean, genuinely, I enjoyed that series.
I didn't like the series. I thought it wasn't a great series, but that doesn't mean to say it wasn't enjoyable, right?
and the character of Saiyaman will forever be a stain on the reputation of all Dragon Ball fans. Because I can guarantee, and I can prove this as well with several of my mates who are diehard Dragon Ball fans, right? I will go through the different characters with them, and I'll say, okay, so what do you think of Saiyaman? And they'll say, well, that's just Gohan. And I'm like, okay, yeah, but what about Saiyaman? Did you like him or not? Well, he was all right. Like, so you didn't hate him? He was all right. You didn't hate him then? Yeah, I didn't hate him. And if you didn't hate him, were you indifferent about him? No, I wasn't indifferent about him. So that means you liked him? Well, yeah, kind of. And this is from the mouths of Dragon Ball fans. So Dragon Ball GT introduced Saiyaman, who people actually like as a character.
I liked the robot.
Everyone likes the robot.
I also liked Time. I think the secret to the series is what it does really well. Is, you know how I mentioned there's a lot of artists and colorists? That's because each issue is kind of split up. There's like the main story, and then kind of the last few pages kind of just focus on one of the characters in detail. Kind of you get to know them a bit better. And I think that's just a process that works really well.
Cool. Shall I take over?
This
then?
Good comic. Buy it.
Yes.
And also hopefully then I'll get some kind of...
Yes. Shall I take over?
Yeah, go on then.
Right. Okay, Andrew. I think when we have our next meeting, I need you to kind of, just the next time I organise my comics for review, just remind me not to link two very confusing titles and cover them back to back.
I mean, I'll almost definitely forget.
But just in case I forget as well, which is, there's no just in case there because I will. Because I've just done Fate Grand Order Mortalis Stella, which... I'll be honest, it makes it sound like you're totally mauled on Stella. But anyway, from there, I jump across to Marvel, to Ghost Rider, Cosmic Ghost Rider, Destroys Marvel History, which is part of Marvel's long-running and ever-growing in popularity series of so-and-so character destroys or beats up all of the Marvel universe.
Oh, boy, it's... the most inexplicably popular type of story with the most inexplicably popular Marvel character.
Well, I mean, we had Squirrel Girl beats up the Marvel Universe, Deadpool kills the Marvel Universe, and Deadpool kills the Marvel Universe again, and possibly and again, wherever the sequel might be. And now
I'm not sure that Cosmic Ghost Rider is even that popular. It's like a character that certain writers really want to push.
Yeah, see... we'll go into Cosmic Ghost Rider's history in a second. But to start off with, it's written by Paul Scheer and Nick Giovanetti. And it's basically Cosmic Ghost Rider Destroys the Marvel History, issues 1 to 6, with pencils by Gerardo Sandoval, Todd Nog, Nathan Stockman, inks by Victor Nava, Antonio Gabella. Victor Nava and... where are we? And that's it. Colours by Antonio Fabella and Rachel Rosenberry. Letters by VC's Travis Lanham. And that's about all, which is a lot shorter than I thought it was going to be. But anyway, it starts off with Ghost Rider, Cosmic Ghost Rider, talking about how he used to be Frank Castle until his family was murdered in front of him. And then he became the Punisher. And then he died and went to hell, made a deal with Mephisto. But then, after that, he made a deal with a slightly bigger demon and then became the Herald of Galactus after he was already Ghost Rider. And then after that, he became the Herald of Thanos, and whatever powers Thanos gave him, he had those as well. And then he basically tried to fix all the problems by taking Baby P. Thanos back into the past so he could raise him as a good kid, which didn't turn out too well because Baby Thanos became... Baby Thanos Punisher, or very adult Thanos Punisher. And he also got stuck back in the past, so that means he's got to kind of try and figure out what's going on. So he does what any normal person would do. Any normal person who fought in a war, came home, went for a picnic with his family, only for his wife and son to get horribly murdered by a group of criminals. Frank isn't the world's greatest detective. So he basically goes home. He goes back to his house that he shares with his wife and his son. his son isn't home, but Frank is calling himself Fredo, Frank's uncle, Frank's very Italian uncle. And then he proceeds to tell the kid loads of stories about his time as Ghost Rider, which is kind of fun because then you've got Ghost Rider narrating the stories to the kid from a very distorted perspective.
Yeah, I feel it deep down in my bones. I just do not care about this character.
Well, it's difficult to care about him because, I mean, the problem I've got with Ghost Rider as a character, or Cosmic Ghost Rider, I've never had this problem with the original Ghost Rider, right? Never, ever. Cosmic Ghost Rider just seems like it's... Do you remember in The Simpsons where, you know, the Itchy and Scratchy cartoon?
Yeah.
They tried to introduce the new character called Poochie.
God, he's Poochie.
Yeah.
Cosmic Ghost Rider died on the way back to his house.
Exactly. And so, yeah, Cosmic Ghost Rider is basically...
Yeah, I get what you mean in this very, like, look, kids, isn't he so cool?
Yeah.
It's all the cool things you like rammed into one thing.
And when you look at it, the introduction of Poochie into the Itchy and Scratchy cartoon, The Simpsons, he was riding a skateboard, he had sunglasses and a backwards cap, and he had a short-sleeve shirt over long-sleeve top. And he was rad, and he was hip, and he was saying things like "bro" and things like that. All the cool things that a 90s kid would grow up on. Whereas Cosmic Ghost Rider is all the cool things that somebody thinks a kid reading comic books wants to grow up on. So you have loads of flame powers and all sorts of powers and powers, cosmic and otherwise, being thrown at Ghost Rider, and he's basically going around destroying Marvel history and changing history and stuff like that.
All those elements are cool, just together. They're just a mush of random things that don't fit together.
Yeah. And what I find hilarious is that it ends up with Spider-Woman and Luke Cage and Colossus and everyone else going to this cave and finding a rather tipsy Cosmic Ghost Rider who's basically got a giant shaggy beard and everything like that. And he's sitting there after, like, several beers, and he's basically reached the point where he's like, look, it doesn't matter. Nothing's going to change. Just don't bother interfering with history. Just leave it. I'm just sitting here to wait until I become Cosmic Ghost Rider again. Don't mind me.
I would have sealed the entrance to that cave.
Yep. So, yeah, I mean, it's this weird and bizarre comic, which, I'll be honest, it took me a week and a half to read, because it's very, very heavy on the exposition. It's very heavy on the monologues, and that can be very distracting when all you want to do is sit back and enjoy the story, because the story quite literally moves at a snail's pace, which is difficult for comics, but they've somehow managed to achieve it.
Bah.
Yeah. Anyway, Andrew, my headache is getting worse after looking at this, so go away, go Cosmic Ghost Rider, join Fake Granddaughter.
Okay, so... Finally, I have got a book, which, much like TIE Fighter, I just read in one go because it was pretty great. Black Hammer 40 is written by Jeff Lemire and Ray Fawkes, with art by Matt Kint, colours by Charlene Kint, and letters by Marie Enger.
Okay.
So this continues the kind of world of Black Hammer, this time focusing on Black Hammer Squadron, an elite team of World War II pilots led by the African-American Hammer Harrison and his friend JP, who I think is probably supposed to be Canadian, and also their other brother-in-arms. Oh no, I've forgotten his first name. His last name is Lee, and I've realised now I'm literally calling him Jet Li in my mind because I've just been imagining him as Jet Li.
Did they draw him to look like Jet Li?
I mean, he looks like, you know, someone drawn by Matt Kint.
Ah, so...
Because he has a not that wide variety of facial structures, but he could definitely be played Jet Li.
Yeah.
So yeah, this story, it starts off in the present day with a now elderly Hammer Harris kind of gathering his comrades to... Because basically it's every 10 years they gather to remember their fallen comrade and their final mission, which is implied kind of went not super great. And that's intercut with flashbacks to said mission. in which Black Hammer Squadron are sent to rescue a Jewish scientist from the Nazis, specifically from, again, the weird running theme of today's show, a Nazi who is also a werewolf, before the Russian Red Tide forces can get to him. The Red Tide being, of course, Russia's elite mech division.
Hey, by gum.
Yeah, and to get there, they also have to contend with the Hammer Squadron's greatest nemesis, the enemy pilot known only as the Ghost Hunter. And by known only as, I mean, I only know because I've forgotten what his real name is.
Makes sense.
Like Heinrich von Germanberg. So yeah, I've really enjoyed it. It's a fun mix of like old school, kind of weird sort of sci-fi-esque World War II comic, but set in a more like realistic version of World War II.
Awesome.
My one criticism of this is that it does end on something that I think is supposed to be a twist, but I don't really get it, and it just comes with being quite confused.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fun. It's a cool war superhero comics mashup. I think Matt Kint's, especially Matt Kint with Charlene Kint on colors.
Okay.
Is actually like really pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, I especially think his style that I would describe as kind of a bit muddy does work really well for this kind of, you know, fighting through like Eastern European countryside type art.
Yeah. I mean, you've become something of a Matt Kint expert these days, haven't you?
I have. I'd almost go as far to say, like we've had our back and forths on his artwork. Yeah, he does some good stuff. Importantly, he draws a damn good mech. A mech which I also like has I'm about to die, screw all of y'all, massive explosion setting.
I like
as well.
Ah.
And I think that probably does us for another week.
Yeah, that's us finished. Right, okay. So that was our November comics blowout. Let us know if there's any of those, anything we covered today that you are interested in reading or have read. Let us know what you think of them. You can leave us a comment below. If you want to catch up with any of our previous episodes, then you can find them all on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, which is undergoing a bit of renovation at the moment. So, you know, if there are any site issues, just please bear with us. On our site, though, you'll also find our Patreon, and you'll also find other reviews from other shows on our network, and also written reviews for movies and video reviews of video games, as well as a few other things that we do on video as well on our YouTube channel. That's it from us. Until next week, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And we will see you all later.
Thanks for listening. Man, it would be cool if we got a load of like angry Dragon Ball hate mail.